Hey guys, today we are talking about the exploration of love as a universal quest that binds all of us to the very core of human existence. It's a voyage that reveals the rich tapestry of our shared experiences, nurturing empathy and a profound connection across diverse cultures and traditions. My guest today is Scott Burns. Scott is an award-winning teacher, speaker, and explorer of love and life. He and his wife, Tony, have journeyed over 100,000 miles by Harley, seeking the nature and meaning of love in varied places, cultures, and lifestyles across the country. Their extraordinary adventure has led them to engage with leading minds in science, arts, faith, and spirituality. Scott's work has resonated far and wide. He's been featured on NPR's Morning Edition, the USA Today, and his PRX radio program, Love is History. Scott is also a TEDx speaker, regular podcast guest, and the author of the upcoming book, A Map of Souls, The Quest of Love's True Story. Scott's passion for understanding love's true essence is an inspiring beacon for all of us. So we learn about love. We're going to learn about adventure. We're going to talk about Scott's journeys. And I am thrilled that we get to talk to him. So let's talk about it in just a minute. Here we go. Scott, you weren't chair dancing with me. How are you today?
I was absolutely in here where it counts. I'm well. Thanks for asking. How are you doing?
I am doing fabulous. Let's get this little adventure going because I want to know more and more about love. What does love have to do with it, as they say?
Oh, you're going to lead to one of our toughest questions we always start our interviews with. And that's what's the greatest love song ever written.
Oh, that is a good one. What is the greatest love song ever written? Let's bounce some ideas here.
Oh, no. We've gotten it. You can go to our YouTube channel and see that video. People have all kinds of different opinions. I can tell you the funniest answer we ever got, though, real quick. If you ever want to have the perfect hippie moment in your life, yeah. We were interviewing a Tibetan Buddhist monk. Kempo Karma Tenkyong at the Karma Triana Dharma Chakra Buddhist Monastery above Woodstock, New York. And we asked him that question. So you ever want to have the perfect hippie moment, sit at the top of the steps of a Buddhist monastery above Woodstock while a Buddhist monk sings you Michael Jackson's We Are the World.
Oh my God. Okay.
It was
That's
awesome.
An adventure. That's going on the list. Check. So, hey, tell everyone about this journey that you started and, like, you know, how did it start and why did it start?
Sure. It's been an evolutionary process for us. I was nearing retirement from teaching. This is mid 2014, 2015. And I'm a writer by trade, you know, I'm a creative writer. That's what my MFA is in. And I was nearing retirement from teaching. I was going to hit the road and write a book about the meaning of being a man in America. I was going to call it Be a Man. But my wife and I, we sat down and talked about it. We've been married for over 40 years. We've done everything together, been in the music business together. We were Renaissance Festival performers together for many years. And I really didn't want to hit the road and do this without her. And so I asked her, if you came with me, what do you think that book would be about? And well, we're well on our way to recognizing that fantasy ideal of growing old together. And as we have, she said, you know, people are always asking us for this big secret to love. You know, what's your secret? And I thought, well, that's it. We'll hit the road. And it was kind of a romantic project. And we thought we'll take, you know, 3 months on the road and we'll ask people in as many diverse places and events and cultures and lifestyles across the U.S. that question, you know, what does love mean to them? You know, what's your big secret? And it didn't take us too long to discover that that's a stupid question. What's your secret? You know, yeah. is a different answer for everybody. You know, everyone's lives are so different. But we discovered by the end of the first year that there's also, as fun as those stories were, and we had some profound experiences with, you know, collecting couples stories about love across the U.S. We also discovered that there was this profound sense of loneliness and disconnect across the country with people wondering, you know, how we've grown so far apart and what it is that could bring us back together. And so that what's your secret question turned into a larger question of, well, you know, what is love, you know, and people started telling us their stories, not just couple stories, but their loves of their hometowns and their art forms and their families and their dogs. And, you know, we discovered that the more stories we collected, the more likely people were to want to hear ours before they tell us their own. It was almost like this sense of wanting to be affirmed, to know that the world was still a good and loving and decent place, and that the people that occupied it, that people still had a place within all that, you know, that sense of human community that they were missing.
Can I tell you something?
Sure, absolutely.
When you started talking, you said you had your MFA and it was about creative writing. Uh-huh. I'm astounded how many things you and I have actually in common. And
I know.
Is another one of them is because I was all about doing creative writing. Uh-huh. So we're just going to keep this mind meld going here. And so when you started, in other words, how do you just walk up to people and say, hey, tell me about love? Isn't that like weird, or is it like not weird? How do you do that?
No, to be honest with you, Michael, it was kind of at first, but we discovered as we realized that we were going to have to be telling a much broader story, but also a much deeper one as well. Going into places where oftentimes we were the only people that looked like us. When we go into, you know, when burned out areas of East Detroit or a community of Vietnamese boat builders or, you know, the Rosebud Reservation here in South Dakota, we are the only white middle-aged biker couple for 500 miles. You know, we got used to being the other. And for people like us, that's it can be an unusual sort of scratchy feeling at first, because you're going, we're so used to being around people that are like us, that look like us, that talk like us and tell us the same stories that we want to hear, that at first that can be a little off-putting. And you worry, you know, does the way I look, the way I am, the way people perceive me, is that going to interfere with our being able to get these stories? But what we found was just the opposite. People were so curious about, you know, y'all ain't from around here, are you? and people were so curious about why we were there. And then when we would tell them, you know, we're Scott and Tony Burns, Journeys to Love. We're here to find out, you know, tell us your love story. Tell us what makes life worth living here. What connects us as human beings?
Where
people
is it
wanted to hear those
going?
Stories.
Where are
I'm
you
sorry?
Going that people are like, you're not from around here. Where?
Oh, I'll give you, because fair warning, almost everything you ask me is going to end up being a story. I'll give you a good, for instance, we were at the Taos Pueblo in Taos, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And the Taos Pueblo is the longest, it's the oldest continuously occupied dwelling in North America. There've been people living there for over 900 years. And the Tewa-speaking people that live in the Taos Pueblo, they have no other real resources. You know, they don't have, you know, a gold mine or something sitting around. They have themselves. And so they have made themselves, and I don't mean this to sound negative, but they've made themselves the exhibit. And so all the way around the perimeter of the Taos Pueblo, people, tourists can go for $17.50 and look in people's front windows. And some of the, you know, some of them actually have signs out front that say real Indian stuff. And we're going, you know, that is such an unusual place in life to be, your relationship with other people to be based on making yourself, you know, presenting yourself in that way. We thought, well, how do you maintain your sort of sense of humanity with people when you do that? What is it like to be in love in this place and then look at other human beings looking in your front window and going, I'm connected with them somehow? We wanted to understand that, to find that story. And so we found the oldest married couple in the Taos Pueblo that had been married 75 years, and we went there to interview them. Well, the fella had broken his leg the day before and it was due for surgery. And the lady that we talked to at the office said, he's cranky. He didn't want to talk to anybody. We totally understand that. But we were still there. You know, we'd ridden 600 miles to get there to do the story, to understand what this mm-hmm. culture was like. And we waited and we thought, well, we need to find somebody to talk to. So we stood in the tourist line, you know, with Tewa speaking woman behind the counter taking money, you know, $17.50. She's not looking at anybody because, you know, this is just to them. This is the product. This is their client. We got up to the window. We handed this woman a card and I said, hi, I'm Scott Burns with Journeys to Love, and explained to her what we did. And we're here to collect a love story. We can't talk to this fella. Who do you know around here that can tell us what love means in this place? And there was this silence And we've gotten used to this look around the country. And she dropped her glasses and she looked at us and she said, "You do what?" And I re-explained it to her, and she says, "Just a minute." And she puts the entire tourist line, you know, like 50 people waiting in line, on hold so she can call her friends and start finding somebody for us to talk to. And eventually another lady came over and took over the ticket sales. This woman took us off to the side with some friends of hers, and we ended up sitting around a table drinking something that I don't know what it was and having a great time and hearing what their love stories were. We found out across the country, you know, that sense of loneliness and disconnect also has this amazing property that when you break through it and all that, I almost said a bad word, all that stuff comes, all that stuff goes away and it comes down. People want to connect. They want to know that the world, you know, that the love that they feel is shared with other people, especially people that don't look and act and seem like them, because it's almost like the world becomes one place again. And it's been glorious to find that with, from Vietnamese boat builders to ranchers in Montana, from hippies in Haight-Ashbury to submarine captains in Virginia, we found this amazing commonality in what brings people together. And that's all. If you ask people what the most important thing in their lives is, you're going to hear a love story. And that's what we're after finding.
Have you found that, love is love. Do people experience it differently? Do people, when they talk to you, do they go like, "Well, this is how we do love," and then you talk to someone else somewhere else and they say, "Well, we do love differently over here." And is it the same, or is it a different experience?
It is a different experience, but I have to share with you something about, I told you this has been an evolutionary process with this whole project. In 2020, of course, you know, when the world ended for all of us, we all have this story in our lives where we're going, "Well, I was living my life, and then, you know, the pandemic happened, and then, you know, we hit that speed bump and everything changed." We had to come off the road, and it affected our funding and our ability to travel and collect these stories. So I took advantage of that time to write the book, the book that you mentioned that's now in the hands of literary agents, and we're hoping to get published in the next year or two. But that the research that went into the book meant talking to people who I had never thought about asking, neuroscientists or people in quantum physics or positive psychology or animal behavior, you know, all these different aspects of love. And we found these remarkable commonalities between disciplines, because you were talking about love across cultures. Well, cultures isn't just ethnicities and demographics. It's also schools of thought, disciplines of thought. And we found these amazing parallels between people in different modes of thought and different cultures we would never have considered, like how frequently quantum physicists were backing up what the Buddhists said about the unity of the universe. Well, now they have evidence. Turns out quantum physicists were just Buddhists with better data. And so when you ask, you know, do people experience it differently? Yes, they do. But we have four key understandings, things that we've found out that all of these different cultures and people and places and events agree on. And one of those things, although they don't often know it themselves, is that love is one thing. There aren't different kinds of it. And when I gave my TED talk, the analogy that I used, I draw a parallel with our senses. You know, if you think of like your sense of sight, you don't think of, every time you see something different or you experience something that you see differently, you don't think that that's a different kind of sight. What you understand is that you're using your sense of sight to visually react to things, to bring in this sensory information. And we found that love is the same way, where we all have one love and it's one sense. But we experience all these different things through it. So when we say, "I love ice cream," or "I love my wife," or "I love my dog," people think those are different kinds of love. They're not. Is that different ways that your sense of love is experiencing those things. And that's why, you know, when we've asked people to define love for us around the country, we've asked, you know, like you said, we've traveled 100,000 miles in every state, every different culture and place and type of person you can imagine, and ask that question, "What is love?" Yeah. No two of those answers have been exactly the same. Because back to that sight analogy, it's almost like asking people, if you ask them what the sense of sight is, you'd get an answer. But that's not really what you're asking them. What you're asking them when you ask them, "What is love?" is like asking people, "What does what you see, what does it mean to you?" And so we understand that, my gosh, those answers are going to be totally different and completely subjective, even though we all understand we have one sense of sight that, you know, we all share, that people have different acuity or different, you know, abilities with their sense of sight. But we understand that we all basically have that same potential. Love is much the same. It's one thing that we all share, but we all experience it differently. And when we try to tell people about it, it always sounds like, oh, we have all these, you know, different versions, different kinds of love, but we really don't. We're just seeing things differently.
You know, you gave me a picture that I think is fabulous. And I think it kind of ties into what you were just saying about love and experience. I'm just going to throw it up here and let you explain it to everybody.
Oh. Well, again, we're back to the evolutionary process of love or of this project. What we were really on to and the depth of what we were discovering really came to us the first time is the sign is sitting out in front of a place called the Dog Chapel in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. The Dog Chapel is this wonderful classic New England colonial era style church that was built by an artist named Stephen Huneck and his wife. Stephen's since passed away. But the entire dog mountain that he bought and this chapel are devoted entirely to the memory of dogs and the people who have loved them. And we were sitting there watching as people, you know, people and dogs of every stripe and hue, every shape and age, were hiking trails covered in paw prints and splashing in the dog ponds and exploring the dog art gallery. And they had covered the alcove of this chapel, an inch deep, floor to ceiling, with photos and drawings and tear-stained notes expressing their love and their gratitude for, you know, departed friends. And they were so profoundly united in that place by this love that they shared that all the other stuff between them vanished. There was just, you know, the differences between us become interesting points of conversation, not division. And this marquee that sits out in front says, you know, welcome all creeds, all breeds, no dogmas allowed. And it just captured that sense of, you know, when we share this thing called love, in this case, you know, our love of departed dogs, we bond. All that other stuff just becomes points of conversation. Now, I have to share with you a little extension to this, because the depth of all this came to me because as I was sitting there looking at that sign, watching all these people and enjoying that this perfect harmony, I was also, because we're always multitasking, and I was looking over video on my phone of an interview we'd done with a man named Bhante Dhammapala. And he's a former U.S. Marine turned Theravada Buddhist monk. And we found him eating enormous plates of dolmas in this Greek cafe in Des Moines, Iowa. And when we asked him to define love for us, we asked him that love is question, he gave us this wonderful scholarly lecture about a link between the Buddhist Noble Eightfold Path and Corinthians 13:1. And if you're familiar with the passage, it says, yea, though I speak in the tongues of angels, I am but a clashing cymbal or a sounding gong if I have not love. And it's, you know, a beautiful thought. And I was thinking, well, how am I going to edit this? Because I just want to include everything he had to say. And as I'm thinking about this and watching his interview, I discovered that I'd forgotten to turn off the camera when we were done with his interview, my phone camera.
Yep.
Because I was probably distracted by the novelty of helping a Buddhist monk climb under the cafe tables at the lunch rush to look for his pickup truck keys. And we paid our check and we walked out onto the Grand Avenue sidewalk, and my camera is still running down by my knee, and it turned, and there's a street person or a street nomad, you know, traveling musician, itinerant player we run into all over the country. And he's playing a guitar with an inlaid mother of pearl Star of David on the pick guard. He's singing My Sweet Lord, which is a George Harrison tune about Krishna. Yep. And in that shaky, sideways, accidental few minutes of video, a Buddhist monk is quoting Christian scripture to us in a cafe owned by a Greek Orthodox family down the street from a pagan metaphysical shop, while a Jewish kid sings a song to a Hindu god written by a Roman Catholic who died a Gnostic seeker. And love had brought all of this scene together for me, re-witnessed at a place with the love of my life, in a place devoted to love. And in that moment, it really struck me how across cultures and faiths and disciplines of thought and time, we all get it. We just forget that we're all in that same, that sort of oneness of love. The things that divide us, we've gotten so used to starting with the things that divide us. Who did you vote for? You know,
yep.
That we forget that there's something much deeper between us than that. You know, who you voted for, that guy's going to die.
Yeah.
One day that guy's
that
probably sounds harsh, and I don't mean it to, but my point is that the things that divide us are so trivial mm-hmm. compared to the things that unite us, and the things that, you know, the great thinkers and you know, one of our icons for this project is, of course, is Martin Luther King. And, you know, the kind of love that Dr. King tried to tell us about, the kind of loves that Krishna and Buddha and Jesus and you know, Florence Nightingale and Nelson Mandela, they've been trying to tell us for years, we are one. All this other stuff does not have to divide us. And when it doesn't, we discover something remarkable in one another.
I got a question about that. And that,
sure.
And
sorry, I get off soapbox.
No, I love the passion. Matter of fact, I want to make a movie just you like emoting right here. But
okay.
You know, if one of the biggest things that we have coming up is this 2024 election, mm-hmm. just bringing me down. How do we get people to realize that we're all kind of looking for the same thing? We all love each other. And it's not about just, you know, this point of view, that point of view, but
right.
We kind of want the same thing. How do we remind people of that?
Well, you and I chatted about this a little bit before we went on, but we have to remember that we can't start from the top down. We're not going to change the world by trying to get everybody in the United States, the 325 million people, to change the way they vote. You know, I can be able to talk to everybody that way or convince them, or, you know, and we can't start with a message of, gosh, can't we all just love one another? Because most people think, you know, yeah, that may be a beautiful meme, but it's the kind of stuff that, you know, people say who sit in trees with their shoes off and smoke sandalwood incense made out of real sandals. You know, that just doesn't make any sense to them. They don't understand. So when we try to make those human connections with one another, what we've found on the road is we don't start by asking people, you know, what is love? Or, you know, we have some pretty deep questions that we ask people, and you can see some of those on our YouTube channel too. You know, what happens to love after this life's over? You know, what happens to love after death? We don't start with that stuff. We start with, what's the greatest love song ever? Hey, who's a better cook between the two of you? If you want to change the world, we change the world by making connections. And you don't often make connections by yelling at people, telling them they're wrong, or starting with something that's so deep that they're going to think you're out of your mind. You start by saying, nice dog. Can I pet your dog?
Yeah. Yeah. If you walk dogs, you know that you know the dog's names more than you know the people's
names. Yeah. Yep.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You had a parable that you were telling me before about some starfish, and I just love what you told me. Can you tell us that parable again? I thought
oh,
it was fabulous.
Yeah, it's because I'm giving an address to a psychology conference in Denver in October. And because this work can't just be, to me, it can't just be feel-good stories. You know, there has to be, I feel like we've been gifted with the ability to do this and to have these experiences and to meet the people that we have. And to return that, I want to give something practical back. And so I was a teacher. You mentioned that, you know, I was a teacher for 24 years. And so much of what we've learned is applicable in teaching. You know, in a nutshell, we learn best from the people we love, and we teach best the people we learn to love. And that doesn't have to happen by accident. There's practical ways that you can go about in the classroom, setting up an environment where love becomes part of your pedagogy. This conference that I'm talking to in October, I've also discovered that psychologists and social workers and faith leaders, people that are in what we call the helping professions, could also benefit from this work. But one of the problems, the challenges that people in the helping professions face is called compassion fatigue, or, you know, emotional burnout. It's the cost of caring too much for too long for too many. And for people in the helping professions, that can be a very difficult thing, because you see so many people in need, and sometimes you wonder how on earth you're going to be able to help them all. And so the parable that I shared with you is a way of, it's called the starfish. It's from a book called The Star Thrower. And it's often called this, the vignette's called the Starfish Parable. And in a nutshell, what it says is, there's an old man who's a writer, and he's in the habit of walking on the beach before he begins his work every day. And one morning he walks out on the beach and he sees that there's been a storm and there's been starfish washed up on the beach as far as the eye can see in both directions, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of starfish. And there's a kid on the beach who keeps leaning over and picking things up off the beach and throwing them into the water. And the old man doesn't know what the kid's doing. And when he gets close enough, he asks him, he says, hey kid, what are you doing? Kid says, well, you know, all these starfish got washed up onto the beach. And if I don't stay, you know, if I don't throw them back in the water, the sun's going to dry them out and they'll die. And he picks one up and he throws it in the water. And the kid says, the old man looks at him and he says, you have to be crazy, kid. Look around here. There's 100,000 starfish within 20 feet. You can't possibly make any difference. And the kid picks one up and throws it in the water and says, well, I made a difference to that one.
Yep.
And so for people in the helping professions, you know, that metaphor is clear that you help the ones that you can. And yes, you make a difference to that one. But that, as inspiring as that story is, there are things that it doesn't tell us as well. And one of the things that I bring up with people in the helping professions that are dealing with emotional burnout, that sense of, I can't possibly help everyone. No, you can't. But you don't have to. Because what you forget is around the bend, there's another kid on the beach. You are not the only one throwing starfish. You know, there are you and I, Michael, the people that are listening to this podcast. You know, sometimes we lose that sense of hope and we suffer from the kind of compassion fatigue for our world that says, how can I possibly make a difference when there's all these people voting this way or doing these things or believing this stuff? You know, we look as a teacher, every time I see another story about gun violence in the schools, I go, how can one person possibly make a difference in all this? But I'm not alone, you know, and part of the glory of this work that we've been able to do is to constantly be reminded that people are basically good. There's love between us. There's powerful stories all over the country of people whose love is making the places that they live better, the people around them stronger, that are offering hope. We just forget. I'll tell you, I got to share one other thing with you. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I love what you're doing, but go ahead and tell me that story, because I want to ask you, like, how do we as normal people who don't get out of the Harleys, change the world? So please continue with what you were just saying.
Yeah, this may cross over between both of those points, because I was going to say, we were in Lexington, Kentucky, and we were forwarded to a woman at a Cajun restaurant sitting there trying to enjoy her lunch when these two bikers from South Dakota come up and start asking her questions about love. And she was remarkable. Her name is LaTanya Jones. And LaTanya is, she's an advocate for the families of death row inmates. She gives courtroom testimony sometimes as a character witness for people on death row, and she advocates for their families, who are oftentimes the forgotten people in these kinds of, you know, terrible criminal cases. And I was very curious with her, with, you know, the kinds of situations that she faces and the human dynamics that she has, that she encounters every day in her work. How do you maintain that sense of love and, you know, connection with people when you're faced with, you know, the most horrible circumstances between people, violent acts, you know, that end people's lives? And she said, well, when we asked her that question, love is, she answered it by telling us love is available. And she said, I'll tell you what I mean by that. She said, we forget, you know, that when all these terrible things happen to us, we think, well, I can't be talking about love because I got bills to pay, or I just got profiled by the police, or, you know, all these terrible things that happen to us. But we forget that love, that there's something else wonderful happening at the same time, all the time. While we're diverted by that, around us is always love. There are people, these families, even though, you know, this terrible thing has happened to them, they're brought closer together through it. There's always something else remarkable and wonderful and inspiring and affirming happening at the same time. And whenever that happens to me and I start to despair, and I do, you know, when, I mean, we're faced with pretty dark times in this country, in this world. The challenges that we face as human beings and humanity can seem incredibly daunting. And I just keep remembering LaTanya looking at me and saying, don't forget, love is available. You can choose to find it again. It's always there.
I love that. There's so many questions I want to ask you about love, like whether or not people love their pets more than they love other people. Do they like, how do they share this love? Uh-huh. I want to dig deeper into who Scott is. That's what I want to do. I want to play a little game with you that we do with a lot of guests that come on here, and it's called This or That. Okay. And I'm going to give you two options. You can choose one or the other, but you can't choose neither or both.
Okay. There's no buzzers, is there?
No buzzers, but you know, so we'll make it easy. And you know what? One of the questions I have avoided asking these questions to everybody on the show ever. And I asked it once, I think last week or something. And it seems like the most inane question, but maybe it tells more about people than I actually think. So I want to say, what's your favorite drink to start the day? Is it coffee or tea?
Oh, it's coffee. I'm a coffee hound. I'm picky about the bean.
Okay. Yep. I'll start with a bunch of easy questions, and then we'll get maybe a little harder, maybe thought-provoking. Let's see what happens. Okay. Which natural landscape do you prefer, mountains or desert?
Mountains.
Okay.
I'm a Colorado kid.
There you go. You and John Denver.
Yep.
Sunrise or sunset?
Yes.
Yes. Which one do you prefer?
Whichever one is coming.
Okay, that's a good way to look at it then. How about when you're traveling, you like local cuisine or comfort food?
Local. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What's been the coolest local food that you found that you don't get every day everywhere?
That would have to be either alligator in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. We got talked into, or the best. We were shocked to find out that the best barbecue we found in the country was in upstate New York, outside of Cooperstown, where the Baseball Hall of Fame is. And we always thought, you know, it'd be, you know, in Texas or, you know, Kansas City or Chicago or someplace. No. upstate New York, man.
Okay, I would not have guessed there. I would have gone for, you know, anywhere in Texas or Memphis.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Second best was Salt Lake City, Utah, which also surprised us. Double surprise, because we were there for what also turned out to be the best pride festival in the United States. And we would never have picked Salt Lake City, Utah for that. We love having our expectations blown. That is one of our favorite things on the road. You know, take what we anticipate and throw it out the window. It's glorious. Awesome.
When you're navigating, you're going from place to place. You like maps or GPS?
GPS. I have to, because, you know, often especially if we're riding together in a city, urban riding is a lot more dangerous than highway riding.
Yes.
And I can't have my eyes diverted from the road. So, you know, the AirPods and GPS are the way we get around.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
What guides your decision-making, artistic expression or logical analysis?
I want to say logic, but I'm an artist at heart.
Yeah. I feel you on that. I'm with you 100%. So what's your approach to exploring new places, either structured plan or spontaneous adventure?
Oh, preference or reality? Because I always start with a plan. But who was the I can't remember, there was a general in the Civil War that always said a battle plan is a plan until the battle.
Yeah, exactly.
And, what happens is, like, you know, last time we were in New Orleans, we had an interview with, and I'm drawing a blank on her name, she's a sister in the you know who the Neville brothers are.
Yep.
Cyril Neville and the Neville brothers. There's a sister in the family. We had an interview scheduled with her that totally fell through, which about 75% of our scheduled interviews do. And then it ended up being one of the best interviews we've ever done with a street trumpeter on the sidewalk in New Orleans. And so spontaneous is what happens, and it's wonderful. I almost wish things would go according to plan, but it's probably better that they don't.
Okay. What fascinates you in a new place, the traditional culture or modern innovation?
Traditional culture. I'm fascinated with the ways that people have built their perspectives and points of view and what binds a culture together. Because I think the only way we're going to be able to bring cultures together is by understanding what they are, rather than coming from the top and trying to change them and force everyone together. You know, if we understood who we were, we'd be a little more forgiving of who we are.
Yeah. I got another one for you. Which way do you prefer to document your travels, written or visual?
Oh, that's a hard one because I'm a writer, so I'm almost always going to defer to writing. But as we've gotten more proficient at the videography, I really enjoy, you know, the visual aspect too. So if I had to pick one or the other, I'd say writing.
Okay. Let's say you're in an unfamiliar place. Do you prefer to lead or follow?
I lead.
You lead.
Okay. I lead.
What, even in a place you don't know?
Well, so, and I think because this has to do with our writing.
Yeah.
Because my wife and I, we refer to it as the dance. We've ridden so long together, you know, both in life and literally on the road, that we're familiar with the drift of our bikes and where traffic is, where our blind spots are. Since I do all the setup for our journeys, I kind of know where we're going, and I've just gotten used to being in the front. And it's comforting for me seeing her in that mirror because I know exactly where she's going to be and she knows exactly where I'm going to be. And it's just, I've just gotten used to that sort of position, which is funny because at home, she's in charge. On the road, I'm in front.
All right. Well, let me ask a question that goes along with that then. So kind of like, how do you balance like the thrill or caution? Like, are you up for risk or safety first?
Oh, if I wasn't up to risk, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing.
Okay.
You know, I'm, you know, we're in our early 60s now. We're barely hanging on because we have put literally everything we've ever owned in the world into making this project work. And, you know, we are working in life completely without a net at this point, and it has been so worth it.
Gotcha. What type of relationships do you seek out, like short-term connections or deep bonds when you go to places?
Oh, I love, you know, as a teacher for all those years, I love forming lifelong bonds with people. I want to know how that story goes, not necessarily just how it ends, but, you know, I think the interweaving of our lives is, you know, that deep sense of connection is part of what gives our lives meaning. I mean, okay. I like just getting to know somebody and having, you know, some fun, but no, I want to share some life.
Okay. While you're on your travels and stuff, how do you describe your growth through travels? Is it adaptation or transformation?
Transformation. This has been a growing process for me, very much so.
Is it more of an inward exploration or an outward discovery?
How so?
In other words, do you learn more about yourself or is it more about learning about other people? Which one is more important than what happens there?
I'm not going to be able to answer this one because part of the message that we're trying to get across and what I've really discovered is that there really is no, and I'll give you a quantum physics example of exactly why this is, okay. If you'd like. But I've discovered that there really is no difference between us. We really are quite literally one. And so any exploration, anything I do for you is also an act of self, of growth and self-preservation and self-exploration for me, because we are part of the same world. We're part of the same love. We're part of the same creation. So there's no, in fact, the title of this talk that I'm giving for the psychology conference in October is called One Times One Equals Oneness, because we're constantly comparing. We're looking at our relationships to one another as if they were one plus one equals two. Uh-huh. Meaning a duality. I'm different from you. And when we add each other together, we get this sum that didn't exist before. And that's not the way it works. We are multiplying each other. We are constantly making new possibilities and connections between us. And one times one is still one. So, I don't think there's... I don't think there's a difference between those two things. If I learn more about myself, I understand you better. And if I learn more about you, I gain insight into who I am.
How do you answer this then? What has a deeper meaning, love given or love received?
You can't give it or receive it. That's understanding number three.
Okay.
Love is not something, it's not transactional. And do you want to dive
into that a little bit, because this is the crux, as Frank Zappa would say, is the crux.
Sure.
Of this.
Can I give you a little further explanation on that?
Sure.
That particular point, because that understanding of the four things that, you know, if we could just get this message across to people, these four understandings, this is number three. Love cannot be given and it cannot be received. It isn't something, it's like back to that sense of sight. I can give you things to see. I can provide things for that vision that you have to experience. I can't give you my sense of sight. I can't give you my love. The analogy I use comes from my science teaching days, and I always compare it to the sun. So we don't get heat from the sun, even though it feels like we do. People, you know, a lot of people think we do because it feels like that and we love it. But there's no solid matter in space for heat to conduct. There's no gas or liquid enough for heat to convect, to sort of move around between the sun and the planets. The sun's electromagnetic energy is radiant. And when that energy strikes the earth, you and me and the trees and the mountains and the waters and the audience, it excites the molecules and the matter of which all that stuff's made. And that vibration, the energy of that vibration causes heat to be generated within the matter of which we're made. You can think of love as being radiant in exactly the same way. When I love you, I'm awakening something that's already within you. I'm not giving you my love. The sun doesn't give us heat, but it warms us. When I love you, I'm warming something that's already in you. And when you return that and I recognize it, you're growing something within me. And both of us, frankly, you know, heat expands. Both of us get a little bigger inside.
That is a fabulous way of explaining love with the sun. I had never thought about it that way. That is profound. But
well, I could take it one step further for you too. And that's, you know, people, when I've given this talk before, because this is the talk that I give to people, you know, consciousness seekers and people in consciousness studies, they commonly ask, well, what about the things that we love? You know, things that don't have that, you know, sort of conscious experience of love or this presence within them that you're talking about. What about the things we love? I said, well, think of it like the moon.
Yeah.
You know, the things that we love can't respond to us the same way. And yet the light of our love is still reflected off of those things. And it makes them more visible and more beautiful to the people around us. This is why people tell us, one of the most common things we hear from people when they try to explain what love is they use this term. They say, well, I don't really know, but you know it when you see it. You just know it. Well, here's why you know it. Because when our love is reflected off those things, when you see, you know, a great teacher loving what they do, when you see a great artist or musician at work, when you see, you know, people pursuing causes, you know, awakening the love around them, you recognize it because that love, you know, is basically reflected off of those things. So, you know, love is your sun and your moon, brother.
Let me ask you, I got two more for you. And I was... I always try and think, okay, this is what I think that this guest might say, or this is what's, you know, what Scott's going to say. But given your explanation here in the last couple of minutes, the question is about journey or destination. What symbolizes your approach to life and adventure?
Oh, it's journey.
Is it?
Okay. Yeah. Because a destination, you know, we think of a destination as being something we achieve or some place that we get to. But then what? Mm-hmm. You know, just life doesn't end because you got to a place. Your journey's continuing. You know, you just reached a fork or a turn or an exit or a convenience store. That's not life doesn't have destinations. It's all about a journey.
Gotcha. Let me ask you one more. Living a dream or facing reality?
Do they have to be distinct?
Maybe not, right? I love the way that you're explaining love, and maybe they're the same thing, right? Maybe the journey, yeah. Destination.
I don't see a dichotomy there. I think your dream can very much become real.
Awesome.
In fact, well, that's a whole nother story. We get into quantum physics and how we know that the observer, your observation is what determines reality. And we know that through the efforts of quantum scientists and quantum physics now. So I would say, you know, your dream is not this ephemeral, ethereal thing. It's what defines what your reality is.
You know what? Let's go into it just for a second. I would normally get cut it off here, but I think what you're saying is kind of bridging science and faith, spirit, that sort of stuff. Talk about just a second, and then we'll go on.
How long do I have? Because I can describe the experiment that shows this, and it'll take about 2 minutes.
Go.
Okay.
Let's hear about it.
One of the best known experiments in quantum physics is called the double slit experiment. And what it means, and the way it works, is if you shine photons, if you shine a light through two microscopic slits, you would expect that on the other side of it, you're going to see two bands of light. You're going to see that light travel through the slits and hit the barrier behind it and make two slits. Or if they're individual photons, you'd expect, you know, bullet holes in the shape of two slits lined up. But that's not what happens. If you're not watching the experiment, what you find is called an interference pattern where waves overlap. Think of throwing two stones in a pond at the same time and those ripples, the way they overact. You see an interference pattern. This is what we mean by light can be both a wave and a particle. It's called wave-particle duality. What determines that is whether or not the experiment is being observed. If you watch it, if you record it, if you're observing it, you find particles. If you're not, and you check the results of the experiment afterward, what you find is the interference pattern. It's the action of being observed that determines the reality of the experiment. And that's not even the weirdest part. If you fire a single photon at those two slits, you'd expect that behind one or the other, you're going to get that little bullet hole, because that's just one photon. It certainly has to go one place or the other, but it doesn't. You still find that interference pattern, as if that one photon were traveling through both of those slits at the same time, and it's entangled with itself, and it's interfering with itself and setting up that interference pattern. What that means is that one photon is entangled with itself, and it exists in a thing called superposition. Meaning it's not really a wave or a particle at all. It's either and both at the same time, simultaneously, depending on what you do. If you're looking at it and you're expecting it to be a thing, it becomes that thing. And for most of us, you know, we think, gosh, that sounds like, again, you know, smoke and sandalwood incense in a tree somewhere. But this is what the cutting edge of quantum physics is showing us. And what all that means for us is it's scientific evidence that the universe really is one thing. Everything in it is entangled, and there's no difference between, you know, it's all possibilities and probabilities determined by the action of the observer. And what'll really blow your mind is what that ultimately means is there has to be an ultimate observer. There has to be, at some point, some universal consciousness that is determining the reality of the entire universe. And since we know that love is part of consciousness, a universal consciousness means universal love. Quantum physics and Buddhists are coming together and saying, yeah, the Buddhists are going, we've been telling you this forever. And now the quantum physicists are going, yeah, well, now we can show it.
Now we can show it, yeah. That ties into people's, like, you know, speaking things into existence or feeling it and making it happen. We should do a whole show on this one day. We'll bring in you, me, Einstein, Schrodinger, and everybody else. And
love it. You know, the people that I interviewed for the book, I've got a whole table full of people that we can bring in from, you know, my best interview on near-death experience came from a neuroscientist who's a former head of neurosurgery at Harvard Medical, Dr. Eben Alexander. And we've got people from all over the country in all these different fields who have come together and said, hey, wait, this isn't a bunch of hippie crap at all. This stuff's actually, this is actually real. This is, you know, love really is everything. We really are all one. This isn't just something that we put on a t-shirt to make us feel good and put a flower on it.
Excellent. Scott, I want people to stay in touch with you for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
So we've got your website at scottburns.com. And for everyone who's listening instead of watching, it's Scott, S-C-O-T-T-E. Burns, BURNS.com, scottburns.com. We've also got your journeys, with an S, journeystolove.com. And we've got your amazing YouTube channel at Journeys to Love. So thank you so much for being on. I've learned stuff. I love talking with you. Sometimes I think we might be actually twin separated.
You are delightful. And if I'm going to have a twin, I can't think of anybody I'd rather have.
Okay. We've got triplets because Caden's in there too. So there's three of us that are lining up on this.
Yeah. Thing, so. I still got to meet him. I've gotten all of his emails. He sounds pretty cool.
So. Yeah, he's very cool. And you know what? We got to do another show with Caden because there's amazing stuff that we need to go into. So
well, Caden, we got to get together over coffee.
We'll do it. For everybody that's wondering, you can find us at afunnywayoflooking.com. And we've got a brand new newsletter that's coming out. It's funnywayoflooking.news. So thank everybody for being there, for being here. And by the way, Caden says, hey.
Oh, great photo. Love that shot.
It is. Oh, isn't it?
It's beautiful. Right? Beautiful.
Oh, my gosh. All right, everybody, we will see you next time. Thank you for tuning in. And it's been real. Bye.